You're listening to However Improbable, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. I'm Sarah Colt.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. Today, we're doing something a little different. It's our first case file episode.
On March 21st, 1919, a paranormal investigator, a viscountess, a mind reader, a detective, and a coroner were assembled in an apartment in London to determine if a woman claiming she could speak to the dead was conducting a real seance. This is not Ghost Adventures or Supernatural, because the paranormal investigator in question was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. That's right, this is our case file episode about Sir Arthur.
If you'll recall from our introduction to the podcast, these special episodes take a look at a particular subject or adaptation related to the stories. And today we're starting with the man behind the canon, Arthur Conan Doyle. We want to discuss Conan Doyle as a person and a writer before we get too far into the stories, in order to provide some insightful context and think about how we, as readers, or listeners, engage with them.
Besides creating Sherlock Holmes, what else is Conan Doyle known for? What was his life like? What were his opinions about detective fiction and the world that he lived in? We just want to look at what he was about and think about our relationship to him and make fun of him a little bit, because that is my part-time job, is bullying his ghost.
Yeah, I think he deserves a little bit of bullying.
So do you want to give us just like a real brief bio of where he was born and where he died?
Conan Doyle was born in Scotland in 1859. He, of course, later moved to England, but he was also of Irish descent. His father, Charles Doyle, was an artist, and he was also an alcoholic, so there was a bit of a rocky relationship there. Arthur Conan Doyle's relationship with his mother was a lot stronger than the one with his father. He attended Edinburgh University as a medical student, which sounds pretty familiar.
Just a bit.
And he spent 6 months as a ship's surgeon on an Arctic sealing and whaling expedition, which I did not know, and I think that's
really
very interesting.
That's, huh.
Right.
I didn't know that either.
And then, of course, he was a penniless doctor, and then later established his own practice.
Yeah.
So, again, pretty familiar sounding.
Yeah, John Watson's a little bit of a self-insert.
Yep. Conan Doyle said that he got his love of storytelling from his mother, who he was really close to, and he also credits his mother for bringing Holmes back to life after he, spoilers, killed him off in, 1893?
Yeah, that's funny.
Right.
It was mom going, you gotta do this for me. That pushed him over the edge, huh?
And Conan Doyle wrote to his mother saying, quote, he still lives thanks to your entreaties.
That's funny.
Which, hey, thanks to Mrs. Conan Doyle.
Shout out.
Senior.
To the Conan Doyle matriarch for that.
Right, so like the stories themselves are a lot more nuanced and complicated and sympathetic towards women's plights in the period than we might expect.
But he was also not pro-suffrage.
Yeah, this is weird, right? He was pro-divorce reform, which you can certainly see in the stories. A lot of these female characters are in the situations they're in because they can't leave their husbands.
Yeah, that's true.
But being opposed to suffrage is just... Yeah. It's interesting that you get up to divorce reform, but you can't make the leap to women also being able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
Or, like, writing a character like Irene Adler.
Right.
And then also not supporting voting rights.
And the text is so... Whenever Holmes has those moments of saying, oh, women are irrational or untrustworthy, it's always condemned.
Yeah.
By Watson's narrative voice or through the context of the story itself, like in A Scandal in Bohemia. So it's interesting to say, like, if the narrative is saying, well, actually, women are capable of rationality and are capable of intelligent thought, but we don't want them to vote.
Then what's the deal?
I guess.
What's the deal, Arthur? That's a big question.
Right.
What's the deal with the knighthood, Arthur?
Well, it's not great.
No, not great.
So this, again, it gets back to Arthur Conan Doyle's relationship to empire. It's interesting to me that he is of Irish descent, which obviously Britain colonized Ireland, and in this time period and in the future, you know, beyond the 19th century, its treatment of the Irish was horrendous. But Conan Doyle has really sort of subscribed to the British-English perspective here. And I know he's made a couple comments that are sort of stereotypical, like stereotyping the Irish and about his own, like, relationship to the Irish. And I would be really interested in seeing, like, now that we're rereading these, if that ever
comes up
in the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible that those lines about, like, socialist organizers in The Study in Scarlet was not something I really noticed until rereading in a, you know, a different context in which I was first introduced to it, so.
Conan Doyle did serve in the British Army in South Africa, and he received a knighthood for serving in a field hospital.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily that he was being knighted for his writing, although he did later write a defense of the Boer War, which he actually thought is why he got his knighthood. That's what I'm calling a black mark on his biography
here. A big
here.
Woof.
A big one. A pretty big one.
Yeah. In addition to writing detective fiction, he was a prolific writer and wrote war histories and nonfiction and stage plays and stuff that's almost verges into science fiction.
Adventure fiction, historical novels.
And the other most famous fictional character other than Holmes is Professor Challenger, who is sort of a zoologist and an explorer.
Yeah, he's like an adventurer.
Yeah. I mean, they're interesting because they are kind of like fantasy science fiction time period.
So The Lost World is the novel in which Professor Challenger appears. Like, have you read this?
I have, yeah. It's been a while, but
I have not.
And I think he was most proud of his historical novels and war histories. And people sort of agree that those are the best written.
At least in the time period in which they were being published. Nowadays, I don't know if people would look back on those and be like, oh, these are better than Sherlock Holmes.
And then he also published like 60 books about spiritualism.
Yeah, so let's talk about...
So let's talk about...
this!
Arthur Conan Doyle, paranormal investigator.
Oh, boy.
So he really, I mean, towards the end of his life, really did not consider his writing or his detective fiction the pinnacle of his work. He considered his interest in the occult and his, like, spreading of spiritualism, not only in Britain, but in America, to be the thing that was the most important thing that he did. And when he died, he was one of the most well-known proponents of this belief that the living could communicate with the dead. And not only was did he believe in it, he was convinced that he had done so many times and had communicated with the mother in question. He spoke to his mother's spirit and several of his children's spirits, and also the ghost of Charles Dickens.
I feel like seances where either you're contacting Charles Dickens or you're contacting Oscar Wilde.
Yeah. Or your mom.
Or your mom, which makes the most sense out of all of them.
I would rather talk to my mom than Charles Dickens. Apparently, Charles Dickens's ghost was a fan of Sherlock Holmes, though.
Of course. You need that Chucky D endorsement.
Wild.
So, spiritualism... how do we even define spiritualism? So spiritualism, at the point in which Conan Doyle was really into it, was really at its height. Yeah. It started in, mid-1800s, and then escalated through the end of the period, and then continued into the early 20th century, at the time, of course, which Arthur Conan Doyle was conducting his seances. It's sort of like this alternative religion, but it is not necessarily incompatible with Protestantism, I suppose.
What's interesting to me about it is in the United States, it really caught on after the Civil War with people wanting to find closure with loved ones whose, you know, bodies were buried in mass graves all across the eastern United States. And they never, like, got the closure of so-and-so is dead and I've buried them. So that, at least in the U.S., is really where it picked up steam.
And that makes a lot of sense.
When it's talked about, it's always talked about as sort of cultural reactions to these tragedies. And so we kind of contextualize Doyle, which he was interested in it as early as like 1881. He was talking about it, and his first public speech about it was in 1917, but it was sort of post-World War I, and then post the death of his son in 1918 that he, like, was really publicly writing treatise after treatise and giving all of these speeches mm-hmm. publicly all over the country. And he, like, did speaking tours in the United States.
Yeah, who wouldn't prefer for that to be real? Yeah. Right? It's also, I think, worth noting that, like, at the same time that this is ramping up in the 19th century, you are having the proliferation of the art of photography.
Yes.
You're having increasing interests in the occult, and which is also sort of married with Egyptomania. And then also the fairies, which is, like, a whole nother thing.
He was dead but, convinced, essentially, that he published some photos of fairies in the Strand, which...
Which, of course.
That's fine. Sure. And so it was interesting because, at least in this time period, like in the 1920s, towards the end of his life, his public fervor around spiritualism kind of eclipsed other parts of his reputation. And my favorite story about this is his kind of famous beef with Harry Houdini, the magician. And they were friends before Doyle got really fixated on this. And Houdini spent a bunch of time trying to disprove that any of this was true, and they kind of had this, like, public falling out because Houdini was like, yeah, no, you're a quack. Knock it off.
When I was in London last time, I went to the Wellcome Collection, and they had a whole exhibit about spiritualism and about early 20th century magicians. So they had, like, Harry Houdini stuff, and they had one of those boxes where they saw the woman in half, and they had a recording of Arthur Conan Doyle that you could put your headphones on and listen to him talk, which is probably on YouTube, but I had never heard him speak before.
That's interesting.
And it was really fascinating. There's this whole idea of spiritualism as not only this alternative religion, but also as a form of entertainment, which it certainly was. And so I think you do get Conan Doyle as the more, like, earnest believer here, but there was this broader public belief in spiritualism, but also awareness that it was an entertainment as well. So you have all these, like, sort of believing in these things seriously, but then also just, like, having fun and recognizing that a lot of it is theater.
If you can't listen to podcasts, I guess watching someone connect to seance is probably a pretty good time.
Yeah, I would go to a seance.
Yeah, I would do that I mean, maybe not right now. I don't know if you could do a virtual seance. I don't think that would work very well. I liked this. I found this quote sort of summarizing this, which is something he wrote a couple days before his death in 1930. And he wrote, "The reader will judge that I have had many adventures. The greatest and most glorious of all awaits me now."
That's nice. Arthur Conan Doyle becomes famous for creating the most rational person on the planet.
Right.
And then is meanwhile so deep in it.
Yeah.
Thinking that fairies are real. You can photograph them. They're in the forest 24/7. And also, I'm talking to Charles Dickens, who is a fan of my work.
Yeah.
So this brings us to the reason we are all here. Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Doyle versus Holmes. Battle royale of the century. His feelings about Holmes are about as complicated as our feelings about him. He was really bitter and frustrated that people loved his detective stories so much and would not read his war histories, to the point where... No spoilers for the final problem, but he made a great effort to end the Holmes stories and then was sort of, like, impassioned public. We're like, please, we love them so much. And eventually he brought them back and wrote, you know, 40 more.
Lots more.
So many more. They have sort of a tempestuous relationship, Doyle and his detective. Like Dr. Frankenstein, but more analytical.
Sherlock Holmes coming back and murdering Conan Doyle's entire family.
I think someone should make that into a movie.
That would be a good pastiche. And that'd be a good, like, supernatural biopic. Like,
very meta.
So I think the broader question here, and the reason that we wanted to actually do this episode about Conan Doyle, is to think about how we as 21st century readers feel about Conan Doyle beyond the fact that we love to bully his ghost. So how do we reconcile our love for these stories while recognizing not only their faults, but those of the man who created them? There is no facet of culture in the West that is untouched by Sherlock Holmes. So how do we deal with all of the problems of Conan Doyle and the fact that we love these stories? It's really complicated and sticky, I think.
Yeah, what do you think in terms of trying to develop nuance in your relationship with authors that you love or maybe love to hate?
I mean, I think nuance is the key, right? I personally feel that it's good to know the context and history so that we can actually remove authors like him from the high pedestal, which doesn't mean that we have to throw the stories away or anything. I just think that we have to be careful about valorizing these figures who had bad opinions and did bad things. You know, no matter to what degree you were engaged in the imperial project, it's bad. So my broader point here is that it is okay to like things or to not like them. And it's good, I think, to criticize things and to be critical of things rather than taking things at face value or to understand the world in black and white. We have inherited a very complicated literary history, and I think there's a lot to be gained in reading Sherlock Holmes, not only as entertainment, which you can do just as entertainment, but also as snapshots in time. This is why I'm so interested in the 19th century, you know, to be able to understand where we have culturally inherited the world from and the reverberations of it that we are still feeling.
Yeah.
So what about you? What is your approach to dealing with this situation?
First of all, I want to say something about what you mentioned about this, like, act of criticism. This idea that criticizing work of any kind, Holmes in our case, doesn't mean that you hate it or that you think that nobody should read it or that you think that everything that's derivative of it is bad. It sometimes it means that you love it or that you love it enough to want to pick it apart and sort of challenge it to evolve and to be better and to have a higher relationship to it, which also just how I think about fiction in general is I love to pick fiction apart.
Yeah, it's fun. I think it's fun.
It is.
So,
and I also love to complain.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Those things go together very nicely in this case. You know, there were books that were really formative to me as a young reader and as a young writer. And I have a much more complicated relationship both with them as stories and with their creator now. It's also emblematic of the kinds of relationships I think we should develop with all writers of any kind, even ones whose work is not historical or even ones who we can, you know, sort of easily look and say, well, you didn't think women should vote or lots of your stories are super racist. So we're obviously not on the same side of those opinions. But just working from this perspective of maybe I'm going to like consider how your thoughts or your perspectives impact your work and then think about how my thoughts and perspectives impact how I feel about that and have sort of a what I would call like a mature, like living relationship to stories, which is particularly important, I think, for stories that are sort of in the popular canon of what we think of as literature.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, these stories are a really nice way to dive into that history and to spend some time with some stories that you really do genuinely love, but then also allow yourself to expand your idea of what it means for these stories to hold the position that they do and what that says about the world that we live in, and to recognize like how these stories have helped develop popular thoughts about gender or about empire or race
or policing
or disability or, you know, any of the various topics that the Sherlock Holmes stories deal with. So it's never about kicking these stories to the curb, I don't think.
No.
Obviously, we wouldn't be doing this podcast if we felt that way.
No, like if there was nothing redeemable about them or if I didn't like them, I would probably just complain about them on Twitter, but I certainly would be spend much of my time talking about them.
You don't get to the point where you recognize that there's an issue with something and then eject it from your life, right? It's a continuous engagement. If you want to eject it from your life, go for it. You should feel free to do that.
I think it is personal, and it sort of depends on the context. You're going to bring your own perspective and the way that you feel. And sometimes it is, I mean, there are content creators who it's like, you have done something so bad, I can never engage with you again. And I never even want to like talk about your movies, like Woody Allen.
Yeah.
But those things are sort of on a scale. And I think having that nuance is sort of knowing what the line is for you or where you fall, because there isn't a checkbox where it's like this one writer has never had an opinion that I don't agree with, and so this is the person that I'm going to uphold forever. Like, everybody has thoughts that are complicated or that you might not jive with, even if they're not even, like, politically incorrect. It's just, like, we don't see eye to eye about this. And particularly every, like, heralded male writer. They're gonna have done something or written something or said something that you're gonna have a problem with.
Right. And I think that's the point, is to be able to use stories to think in the future more purposely and thoughtfully and critically about how you engage with stories in the world and how you engage with people in the world. So they're a mode, they're a vehicle of learning about how do I engage critical thinking and how do I create empathy and how do I understand what are my own limits and am I giving money to this person
what are my values compared to the stuff that I'm reading?
Yeah. The point of it is to just be able to understand that literature isn't black and white and these issues aren't black and white, but they should be able to propel us to think more critically about the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I land with Arthur Conan Doyle, is if I time traveled back to the time period and met him on the street, I'd be like, what on earth are you talking about, Arthur? But also, I reread his stories every year and they're so meaningful for me. And he has his moments where he's an amazing writer and an amazing storyteller and an amazing, like, detective murder mystery spinner. And both of those things are true at the same time. And that's okay.
It's complicated.
So more to the point, maybe my final point here, is people often, this is what Arthur Conan Doyle saw for his detective or wanted with these stories. And if they ever say that to you, you can laugh at them for two reasons. The first of all, you don't need to be super concerned about what he would have wanted. I'm not super concerned about what he would have wanted. And second of all, he is literally out there in the afterlife begging people to never, ever speak about Sherlock Holmes again. What he would have wanted for his detective was
nobody to ever talk about him, reference him ever again.
For everybody to get on the spiritual horn and go, hey, Arthur, what's happening? Which I'm not about to do. So he would hate this podcast. And that's fine.
That's how we want it.
So I hope you enjoyed
that. Join us next week.
If you want more of what's going on here.
If you want more of us ruining Arthur Conan Doyle's
afterlife.
Yeah, whole thing.
Yeah, I'm going to get out my Ouija board and I'm going to go, hey, Arthur, join us next week for a trip down memory lane. So our next story is the short story, The Adventure of the Gloria Scott, which we're really excited to air. You can contact us on Twitter at ImprobablePod and find more information about the show on our website. It's howeverimprobablepodcast.com. If you're enjoying the show and you can spare a moment, please rate and review. Unless you're Arthur Conan Doyle's ghost, and then I don't care what you think.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle, but not today.
One apology.
We'll allow it. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.